Well, first, good afternoon. I want to talk about wealth and inequality in London, but I've added, in effect, a subtitle, which is, and London's capacity to do anything about it. So I want you to bear with me on this, because I'm going to make an argument that, in effect, that the position of London in the nation is heavily determined by the very centralised nature of the British state, particularly in England, and that, therefore, many of the things we talk about are all, to varying degrees, the way national government in this highly hyper-centralised system deals with London, but it would actually also be true of deals with anywhere else in the United Kingdom. And there's a paradox at the back of London, in my view. So strong, yet so weak. So, you know, in a sense, a lot of today is about how powerful London is, how successful it is, all of this stuff that we hear again and again and again. And yet, as a political entity, it's amazingly weak. There are villages in other countries that have more independent power than London does to govern itself. Now, I'm going to come on to this because it tells us something, I think, about the UK, the British political class's view about the rest of the capacity, the political capacity and the democratic capacity of certainly England, which isn't actually very encouraging. But we'll come on to that in a moment. So it is true that Britain is it's an incredibly strong place. It's 25% of the UK economy. I mean, I think Osborne was quoting it as 28% the other day, which is a bigger figure than I'd seen before. 25% of the UK economy, with within it at any point in time, including this one, massive riches. And yet the city itself, the mayor and the boroughs, have virtually no control of any of the state's resources. The state collects money by taxation, and then it makes public policy nationally, and that's it. But it does it from the centre, from a few desks in SW1. And in this sense, London is no different, or virtually no different, to anywhere else in England. A little bit more power, actually, arguably, than some of England, most of England. But it's substantially less power than Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland now have, and they will have even more, but just part of that complexity. And that's been brought about by reasons that had nothing to do with British political establishment deciding Scotland needs a bit of power. It was done by brute political force, by voting, by the use of ballot boxes. So come on to that as well. And this is different from the capital's 19th century heyday. In Britain's heyday, in the imperial time, some of these earlier parts of the Danny's chart was hinting at, in that time, the imperial parliament worried about Canada and India and the dominions of the empire. It didn't worry about Britain. It left that to big cities, to Birmingham and Manchester and Leeds, and to London's rather fragmented but nevertheless local government system. So what we've arrived at is a city that is the product of a number of forces. It's true of all cities. But by many, many measures, it's not just that it's economically powerful, but that it stands out compared with the rest of the UK. I'm fascinated again and again and again by looking at charts that the Office for National Statistics publishes, where they do it by region and nation, and London is above a line, and all the other, everything's at 100, London's above, and all the other nations and regions are below it. So if you look at things like the proportion of a population born overseas, almost 40%. The proportion of the population that's from a minority ethnic group, almost 40%. These are way out different, even to the southeast, which is the place nearest to it. The density of settlement, population growth. Population growth is now 122,000 a year, according to the most up-to-date statistics, faster than any other analogous area in the United Kingdom. Very fast for an old city like London. Public transport system and use. You argue how it happened, but it's absolutely different. That's why public policy is skewed towards railways, you might argue, because people who make public policy and live in London use railways, whereas most people out there use railways occasionally to come to London, perhaps around the other big cities. But by and large, railways are not something that obsesses people outside of London, yet they undoubtedly obsess people, and rightly so, in my view, in London. Attitudes to Europe. If you look at polling, opinion polling, Europe has a completely different, London has a different attitude to the EU, apart from Scotland, than most of the rest of the United Kingdom. I'll come back to this point at the very end. High incomes, high wealth, by some distance. Danny has written more about this than anybody on the planet, different to the rest of the UK, but also very large numbers of low-income people, often in the same local authorities. If you go to North Westminster or North Kensington, these are not rich places. The name of the borough suggests that they're rich, but actually they're not rich. They're poor places up at the north of the borough. Now, for these and many other reasons, London is very, very different to the United Kingdom. Although, because of its epic size, 8.5 million people now, actually, even with all the overseas-born people living in London, there's still 5.5 million British-born people living in London, which makes it the biggest concentration of British-born people in the United Kingdom. So despite looking odd, it's also a British city, a very British city, this very large concentration. I always think, you know, wonder how many people are going to bed tonight who remembered the Blitz. If you just do a back-of-the-envelope calculation, it must be at least 100,000 people will go to bed in London tonight who were here during the Blitz. So, you know, there are, it's a city of differences in many, many different ways. And it's, so it's a very British city as well. Now, one thing we know is that because there are a very large number of rich people here, and many of them do pay taxes, and certainly those on, you know, who are not sort of internationally mobile pay taxes, that London is a major net contributor of taxation to the rest of the United Kingdom, as indeed is the South East. This does give UK public policy a problem. It needs the net yield, more is raised in London from taxation than is spent in London. And that huge export of taxation is very important. You can see this particularly with stamp duty. Overwhelmingly, stamp duty is paid in London, as would mansion tax have been. But because we are part of a political entity, unlike the Eurozone, it is possible automatically to move resources around the United Kingdom. And in the end, whatever you think about London and the South East, people generally do not complain about the fact that they're paying more in taxes than they get back. The money automatically goes to Wales and Northern Ireland and other parts of the UK. It's just part of being in a single financial and political zone. Again, remember the Eurozone, which that's why poor Greece is in the trouble it is. And if London were a city-state, and I'm not arguing it should be, definitely not arguing it should be, it would easily be able both to cut taxes and radically to increase its public expenditure at the same time. It could do both. Now, of course, it's dependent on people moving in and out of London from the rest of the country and the graduates moving in and all the other things, trade with the rest of the UK. But there's no question, it is powerful and it is successful. But it can't do anything about the poverty even inside its own boundaries, because it's such a centralised political system that all decisions about taxation, about spending, about welfare, as we've seen this week, are made in a few desks in SW1. And there's nothing that London's government can do about most of that. And the challenge for this, challenge therefore is, you know, could London's politicians, if they wanted to, be given powers that would allow them to do more, even within their own city, forgetting for a moment the fact that this world that we're looking at is one which national politicians from successive governments have allowed to exist. I think the other thing it's just pausing for a moment to consider is the accident of London's epic scale. I mean, one of the reasons that London is so big and complicated to deal with politically, and a conference like today is a really good time to stop and think about this, is that it was just accidentally allowed to grow this big. The Greenbelt was put in where it was in the late 1930s, 1939, by which time the city had grown to 8.5 million people in a region of then probably 15 or 16 million. Today it's 8.5 million people in a region of 21 million people. Its only real comparators in the world are the New York, New Jersey region and the Tokyo, Yokohama region. Not in terms of population, there are bigger cities than this these days, but in terms of economic power. But in Britain it's concentrated in one corner of a country which actually is not that much bigger than the greater southeast. I mean, it is bigger, obviously, geographically, but the greater southeast, London, the east, and the southeast are hugely dominant within the UK in the way that the New Jersey region, Tokyo Yokohama region, are not as dominant, and therefore the politics of handling them is much more complicated. This is an historical artifact. And the question is, what can you do about it? And the nearest the government, the present government's come up to a policy, which in fairness to it is a little more inventive than much of the regional policy that went before, is, I think, though they don't quite put it like this, to begin to try to build a competitor city. So Manchester is now being, in modest ways, built up as a sort of near competitor to London, a sort of Chicago to London's New York. Now, but of course, it would all have been different if all the cities in the United Kingdom had had 2.5 million people, the big ones that had 2.5 million people in them. So I'm not saying this is a bad thing, it's just where we are left. And the scale of difference between London and the greater southeast and the next equivalent place is profound. And it has massive economic impacts. You know, like, just take one thing like the concentration of theatres in London. It's easy to understand concentration. Works really well because all the theatres are so close together, they become an attractor in their own right. And because they're an attractor in their own right, even more, it's even more attractive to put on theatre just outside the West End, and so on and so on. And if it were fragmented, it wouldn't work as well. If you spread those theatres out around the United Kingdom, the sector would be smaller. So, you know, it's just an artifact of history, this epic scale. So, that London and its scale is the result of history. It's internally fragmented and competitive. John Hall, who's sitting at the back, and I have talked about this for decades. And it's very system of government, actually, gives it an advantage. We think it's a bit complicated, but actually, all these boroughs, all with their different policies, can all have different policies, and they compete. You may not think they compete, but they do. Look at the skyline. Some boroughs don't want tall buildings. Westminster's not very keen on them, so it doesn't have them. Heritage. Tower Hamlets, the city, they have massive numbers of tall buildings. So these boroughs are competing, not just in Britain, in London, in Britain, but internationally. So if you really want to put up a 1,000-foot-high tower quickly, you'll find a London borough that will encourage you to do it. Now, if you had a single system of government for London, some mayors would like it, some mayors wouldn't, and that's what happens in other cities. So even the structure of government is actually, in its way, rather competitively interesting in terms of giving London a further competitive advantage. I would argue, others argue the exact opposite, I might have, but park that thought. And of course, the other thing that London is the result of is central government policy. Remember, immigration policy, tax policy, redistribution policy, all made by national government, all UK central government, nothing to do in most cases with London government at all. Now, this has left mayors in London and London local authorities in an extraordinary position, which I just want to touch on for a moment, and that is that they have to try to achieve local redistribution mostly using development. Okay, that's where we've ended up. So if you are the leader of a borough council, if you're the mayor of London and you want to do some redistribution, let's say you want to build some social housing. Not much money for social housing in Britain, affordable housing in Britain. So what you can do, the best thing you could do would be to build a huge set of tall apartment buildings. Okay, that's a good way of, because what you do then, you get extra income, you get extra income from the council tax, but more than that, the building will have to pay, developments have to pay a community infrastructure levy and now a Section 106 agreement. So we've, in a strange way, ended up trying to create a tax, we've created, in effect, a tax system through development. So Danny's right about the way people rush to London to buy, effectively, banks in the sky, you know, storage facilities in the sky, but the weird truth is, if fewer of them did it, maybe property prices would be a bit lower, but there'd be less money for affordable housing. Okay, think about that. That wouldn't be so good. And if you take a development like Battersea, which is my favourite way of looking at this, the huge Battersea development, which is going to produce something at a different scale and at a different kind as we've ever seen in London, much higher density of development. Why is that? Well, it's partly because the developers, and I don't know the developers, I'm not don't know who they are. Well, I know who they are, but I don't have any dealings with them. But the truth is, the developers have been required by the state to rebuild a power station to English Heritage's most exacting standards. There's a four-chimney power station, which is being rebuilt at the cost of the developers as part of that development. Oh, and by the way, because it's not very well served by public transport, a tube spur has been built off the northern line from Kennington, which is also being paid for by the development. Now, the power station will cost about 750 million and the tube line about £1 billion. That could have all been paid for by government, but oddly it wasn't. It's being paid for by the development. Now, do you think it's that in part explains why the development is so big? And by the way, there's also reasonable complaints. There isn't enough affordable housing from the development. And the problem there isn't, probably. But in the end, the trade-off between paying for rebuilding the power station, paying for the tube line and affordable housing is all falling on the development. Now, I'm not saying the developers won't make money out of this. Don't get me wrong. Isn't it awful to be a developer remark? I'm not saying that at all. I'm just trying to explain how public authorities in London are trying to do loads of things with development. And in effect, we're pushing up land values in order to pay for things the state won't pay for. In its most extreme form, we are taxing housing to build housing. That's what we're doing. We're taxing housing to build housing. And there are other ways of doing this, but we've chosen not to. And for the city itself, this is one of the most powerful weapons they've now got, powerful ways they have of redistributing money. Now, you may think it's a very strange way of redistributing money, but that's the only mechanism that most of the boroughs have, remembering their taxes are all capped and national government determines all their allocations of resources. So I think it's very hard to blame London politicians for the kind of problems that many people have identified about the enormous inequalities that exist in a city like London. That's something national government could do something about. So, finally, my last two or three minutes, what might be done to improve this? Well, the most obvious thing to do, I suspect, would be to devolve power to London, actually. I think London politicians would do different things with even with the existing resources. It's fascinating that Danny mentioned the One Hyde Park, where they are indeed paying £1,353 a year in council tax, compared with people in semis, well, forget Barking and Dagenham, you know, people in Liverpool are probably paying more in some housing for this. And, of course, even Conservative politicians like Mark Field, who's the Conservative MP for the cities of London and Westminster South, has written on Conservative Home, saying there need to be more bans in council tax. But where does the problem lie here? It's because successive national governments will not reform property taxation. They won't even have a revaluation of council tax. So we're stuck with 1991 relative values and eight bands, which in no way reflect the top to bottom values today, as compared within within the early 1990s. And that's even different again from the rating system that operated before. All of this could be changed, but national politicians, frankly, have so lost self-confidence that this they cannot tackle. London politicians, I think, would. I think they'd put more bans into council tax. I think there'd be a revaluation, very bad for inner London, very good for outer London, actually, if you did it within London. And they'd come up with a more rational use of property taxes that would choke off the frothy boom. The frothy boom in London property is no good for anybody. It's not good for the city. It's not good, actually. You could argue it's not even good for the rich people who buy it. You know, what we need is a sensibly managed property market, and currently the property tax system is not designed, could be used for that, and it's not used for that at all. It's just frozen, it's atrophied. So that's something I think London politicians, if they were given the powers to operate the full suite of property taxes, I can advertise, I was chaired something called the London Finance Commission, which recommended this and also recommended full revaluations and local operation of all these taxes we reported a couple of years ago. I think this would allow local politicians in London to tackle local issues, which would include inequality or the need for better infrastructure or the need for more housing. The mayoral election next year will articulate some of these, but remember, the candidates, Labour and Conservative, Liberal Democrat, will all be fighting in the world I've described, with very few powers relative to what national government can do. What George Osborne did to the welfare system the other day is far more in an afternoon than a mayor of London would be able to do, frankly, with the best will in the world to change the city over a substantial time. Scotland, remember, Scotland is being turned into what I'm describing. I'm not describing some theoretical idea, something that can't happen in the United Kingdom. Scotland will soon have control, half its taxes, and over chunks of the welfare system. And let me tell you now, the skies will not fall in. Scotland will continue to function, and we will then discover that the UK does not have to have a very centralised government system. I was going to say, I'm nearly done, a couple of words about this. The way we govern England now is as if all politicians, national politicians, believe that somehow subnational government can't be delivered effectively. And that means they don't quite believe in the underlying nature of the political system in Britain. Think about that for an admission, however implied, that somehow you have to have it run by people in London, central London or wherever it is, central government, and it can't be done subnationally. If we did it subnationally, I think then that you'd get different decisions about public policy in London, which would reflect, remembering what happened at the last general election, London was different to the rest of the UK, you get different decisions. So I just conclude by saying I think we need to change the political gravity in London from, two-thirds of the way up the M1 or wherever it is to London. Thank you very much.